This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think we're at the cusp of a change in the life of metropolitan America, whereby people are looking at the future. It's going to be a metropolitan future, and really the most efficient way to get people around is mass transit. In cities, at least.
If you live in the U.S., chances are you've at some point been frustrated that our public transit systems don't do a great job linking urban centers with suburbs, can't get you to the airport or work in a reasonable amount of time, or at all, and cost way too much. You don't have to travel to Tokyo or Zurich or Paris to see that public transportation in the U.S. is not what it could be. But my guest today on Sea Change Radio has done just that. He's John Rennie Short, a public policy professor at the University of Maryland, and he recently published an article in The Conversation detailing the paltry state of public transit in the U.S. and how we got here. We discuss how the political landscape has affected infrastructure development and the many costs associated with the decline of our country's public transportation system, which can be measured in terms of lower GDP, wasted fuel, and lost time, not to mention the terrible environmental toll. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by John Rennie Short. He's a professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here, Alex.
So you have a recent piece in The Conversation, which is entitled, Why is the U.S. Unwilling to Pay for Good Public Transportation? First, why don't you explain what good public transportation looks like?
It just so happened that one reason for writing the piece was Washington, D.C., where I live. The metro had been closed for an entire day, and then it was announced it was going to be closed. Large sections of it was going to be closed for months on end. And at the same time as this was announced, I was in Zurich, Switzerland. And there, it's a clean, efficient, timely system, and lots of people use it. It has no social connotations using urban public transport. It's probably a model, but other places are. Japan has a wonderful system. I remember being in Japan and with a colleague, and he complained that the train was 1 minute late arriving at the station. It made it up by the next one. So there's cities around the world where Moscow, for example, has one of the most beautiful metro systems in the world, the same as St. Petersburg. So you can see around the world and different types of societies, good, efficient, and reasonably cheap public transport. The big contrast with the U.S. was that the U.S. was fortunate that it came into its economic prominence in the 1950s. The downside was that was the time of the motor car. And so it really incredibly embraced the motor car solution to both interstate and intra-urban. Other countries had a harder time with that. Switzerland, for example, gas prices were about 5 to 6 times what they were in the US. So it was a simple case of they couldn't afford the private automobile. I grew up in Scotland where people just grew up with very expensive gasoline. And so public transport was the main source of getting around and was always that. So people got used to it. The system was maintained. Money was invested in it. And the U.S. was just the counterexample. From the 1940s, 1950s, there was this incredible, as I said, embrace of the motor car as a solution for all our transportation problems. And that worked for a while, but now we're actually seeing the disadvantages of that.
And I was surprised to learn a little bit more about the history of public transport in this country, where you write, as cities were designed to meet the needs of the motorists, mass transit systems that had been owned by private companies were abandoned or effectively dismantled in the late 40s and throughout the 50s because they were losing money. And as a result, many mass transit systems were taken over by municipalities. Can you go back a little farther to the beginning of these private companies creating mass transit systems? How did it look in the 20s in the States in terms of ownership?
Sure. It actually goes even a bit further back. Late 19th century, there's beginnings of tram systems, streetcar. There were streetcar suburbs, and almost all of these things were privately privately run enterprises. They made money. There was a customer base. The cities were high density, so you could get enough demand. And they were privately run. Things began to go bad in the 30s. Many of the big, it's almost like a rerun of 2008. And many of the big financial companies would have investing in urban infrastructure, but also would use their money to invest in all kinds of speculative enterprises. So in the 1930s, in the Great Depression, that was the beginning. A number of the infrastructure companies began to go out of business. And that was reinforced in the 40s and 50s with the coming of the automobile and the motorway, the interstates. They were losing customers and they were going out of business. In some cases, they just closed completely, folded up. Most cities either, if they kept them going as municipal enterprises. And that laid the basis for all kinds of problems. It meant that, you know, cities were taking over basically bankrupt systems and had to start from afresh. Meanwhile, compare it with the rest of the world, or much of the rest of the world, where public transport had always been working for over 100 years. It was never abandoned to that extent or left out of major investment.
It also seems pretty interesting to look at how these private companies in the U.S. kind of laid all their eggs in the public transport basket, so to speak. I'm thinking most notably of Japan, where a lot of the large department stores built the rail systems to bring customers into their stores. And so they had an ulterior motive. They weren't purely focusing on public transport as a public good. They had a financial interest in getting customers to their places. And still today in Tokyo, the rail system is dotted by companies that started out as department stores.
Sure. Actually, a similar thing. I was in Hong Kong recently, and the similar thing, Hong Kong is basically owned and developed by about six huge development companies. And every mass transit station, they're really big, but they're sort of encased in malls. And the reason is that these are important hubs for shopping and retail. So these are, around the world, you see this thing whereby capital investment occurred rather instead of public transport, actually around public transport. People could see the symbiosis of it. I said the example of Zurich airport. The airport, you arrive at the airport, there's trains, trams, buses, and the major shopping center. It's one of the few terminals where you can do grocery shopping while you're waiting for your plane. At the same price as outside, by the way. So, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right, Alex. Around the world, there's been cases where businesses have their business model is in association with public transport rather than despite public transport. And in the 1950s and 60s, many companies and big box stores actually moved to the suburbs, and they relied on the private automobile. They sort of abandoned public transport. So we have to almost kind of rebuild the system, whereas elsewhere it's been reinforced and kind of codified into the nature of cities.
I think it's also worth delving into the socioeconomic factors that came into play when people began to invest in these public transport systems. I mean, if you look at Russia, Japan, and Switzerland, one thing that kind of shouts out as a big difference between the United States is they're fairly homogeneous populations. And public transport versus private automobile growth in the U.S. has kind of been used as a wedge issue, almost a way to kind of divide the affluent class from the lower class.
Yeah, it's become a kind of class and race issue in a sense, reinforced over the years so that mass transit, urban public transport was considered a sort of, that was what the poor minorities did. So it was almost couched in a form of subsidy to the poor. Meanwhile, you know, sort of the federal underwriting of motorways was never seen as a federal subsidy in any way. Same as, you know, it's similar to, for example, I'm a homeowner and I receive a tremendous subsidy from the U.S. government for taking out a huge loan, whereas renters, poor renters, receive nothing. It's the same in transport. Car users, get federally subsidized just as much as public transport. But it's not seen as a subsidy. It's not considered a subsidy, but it clearly is. But you're right, Alex. There is a sort of class and race dimension to the public-private transport debate in this country.
I mean, here in the Bay Area, it's really magnified where you have BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, that goes underneath the Bay Bridge to Oakland, which has a much greater minority population than San Francisco. And then you contrast that with the Golden Gate Bridge in North Bay, which has Marin County, which has no rail system. And that is a largely white population.
Yeah, as soon as public transport or forms of become associated with one class or one race, it's then easy to sort of undercut it or undermine it. But when it works well, I think in countries where everyone uses the public transport system, it then becomes a truly public good rather than a source of political partisanship. But when it does work, people respond. Just so happened I was in San Francisco not long ago, and I took the train down to Palo Alto. And what amazed me then was how many people were using the train, how efficient it was. I used a baby bullet train, and it was combining with one of the first carriages, I think, was for people with bicycles. So when it works, it works well. And then when people see the benefits of it, they use it, and it can transcend race and class, especially as more people move to denser, walkable neighborhoods and living in metropolitan areas.
We are riding now on a railroad, singing someone else's song. We've been standing by the crossroads. Take your side and step along. We are sailing away on a river to the sea. And maybe you and me will meet again. Whoa, we've been riding now on a singing someone else's song, sing along.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor John Rennie Short. He's a professor of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. Getting back to the privatization versus the public ownership of mass transit systems in this country. How can we find a nice blend of private interests and public infrastructure investment in order to take on this massive challenge of upgrading our infrastructure and our public transport system?
So one way would to begin would be to see it less as an ideological divide. If you're a customer or a user of mass transit, you don't really care whether it's the federal government, the local state, or a private company that's providing it. What you want is a good, kind of efficient, reasonably priced system. If it comes from the private sector, that's well to the good. I think that public transport, though, is one of those things. The investments sums are so huge. It's a good example of where you could get public-private partnerships. I think you can see this in some parts of the country, and indeed in some parts of the US, where they're getting private money to build motorways and then charging people. We could imagine the same kind of thing happening for mass transit systems. And there's a demand. I think we're at a cusp of metropolitan change. More people want to live in central cities. More affluent people want to live in central cities. There's a demand there. We may be moving to past peak car usage. As people move away from the car, especially the millennials, there is a demand for mass transit. I think there's lots of opportunity for providing, reasonable returns to investors who could see, making a profit. At the same sense as cash-strapped governments are looking for investment for major infrastructure improvements. I can see this as a public-private partnership that's symbiotic, that's mutually beneficial, especially for the consumer. I think we're at a cusp of a change in the life of metropolitan America, whereby people are looking at the future. It's going to be a metropolitan future. And really, the most efficient way to get people around is mass transit, in cities at least.
Well, it will be a challenge, especially when we talk about trying to create bipartisan initiatives. You write in this piece, in the conversation, that over time, Republican-dominated suburbs came to see mass transit as a special Democratic interest and voted accordingly. But you also wrote a piece in February called Want the Economy to Grow? It's Time to Look at Cities and Efficiency. And you make the case in this piece that having efficient, well-moving cities and urban areas benefits us all. Maybe the best way to bring down that partisan divide is to make an economic case for it.
Exactly. I think the economic case for investing in our cities is easy to make. You know, our top 100 metropolitan areas in the U.S. are responsible for roughly 3/4 of our GDP. These are the real engines of our economy. As I said in the previous piece about, you know, wanting to grow the economy, you know, the political debates often get stuck in 20-year cycles of, well, tax the rich or reduce taxes. And these are like kind of tired debates now. One way to improve economic performance is to invest more in cities so that we spend less time waiting for traffic lights to change, less time spent on traffic congestion. If we can make our cities more efficient, I think we would all benefit. So I think that partisan divide is of long standing. It'd be difficult to get over. But that notion of the Republican rural far suburban interests are being slightly outweighed by economic realities. And I think the political rhetoric often clashes with new economic realities. I think the big company, for example, major corporations and companies are looking aghast at the Republican debates, for example. It just doesn't make economic sense to them. So we have like a divide in America at the moment. We have, you know, sort of real economic debates and then a sort of kabuki theater of political rhetoric that just doesn't connect with people's lives in the everyday. If you live in the city, you want reliable, good public transport, not for some partisan reason, but that's the best way to get around. It's cheap, it's efficient. It's getting more and more frustrating to drive cars and be, you know, to be a motorist in cities, and it's only going to get worse.
You write that trying to raise the gas tax is politically unfeasible still, and it hasn't been raised in over 20 years. And yet the challenge for urban planners and politicians would be to try to implement something that could reduce driving. But if they don't have a mass transit system as an alternative that's really good and can take everybody all over the place for a reasonable cost, then they're not really doing anyone any favors. So how would a good policymaker find an appropriate compromise within that framework?
Yes, I think is that there's a number of things at work. One is, I think, an important argument is the notion of economic efficiency, I think. The sense of, like, we're losing out in jobs and income because our transport is inefficient, our infrastructure is collapsing. These are not, you know, unreal issues. These are hard economic issues. So the argument, I think, needs to be posed much more carefully by politicians that there's a real economic rationale here. There's also the very important issue of equity and kind of fairness. One of the things that's affecting, you know, lots of low-income people is high transportation costs, either having access to mass transit or having to make long journeys to work. And I think that that notion of equity and economic efficiency begins to at least provide some basis for bipartisanship. So you're speaking to people who are concerned with the efficiency of the markets, of profits, but you're also concerned with people who are making it a fairer city for everyone to be involved in. I think we just lose out. I mean, we lose out when people can't get jobs. And many people can't get jobs because they can't get access to jobs because public transport is unavailable. Private transport is quite expensive. And I think one of the things that's happening is you're almost getting a suburbanization of poverty in many big cities in the US. That the poor, you know, as the rich move into the cities, the poor are shunted out to the more distant suburbs. So the argument for getting better public transport or easier mass transit for people out in the suburbs is now an issue of social equity as well as economic efficiency. And it may sound pie in the sky, but I think you look back at the 1950s and Eisenhower and the big motorway scheme, we need to think big. I think one of the problems is our politics has got very small and very mean and very nasty. And I think people in their hearts are looking for something big, something bold, and something encompassing, both the notion of markets, but the notion of fairness. I'm very optimistic, and I see this in a sort of generational shift. Who would ever imagine that a self-declared socialist would be running such a great campaign in the Democratic primaries? 25 years ago, that would have been just unthinkable.
Unthinkable, that's right.
Often you never win arguments. It's this, the scientific view is that, you know, not everyone believed that the world was round all of the time. It's just the people who believed it was flat begin to die out. And you win arguments one funeral at a time. And I think we're at a period when a time of generational shift when young Americans have less ideological baggage than their parents or grandparents did. And they're looking for kind of real solutions for their real lives. So I think maybe not this election cycle, but definitely the next one. I think big, bold, and encompassing. That's what people are looking for.
Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to John Rennie Short. He's a professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. It is encouraging to see these trends moving in the right direction, but I also noted in your piece, you write, ridership rates vary by city and with the price of gas, but the overall usage trend is upwards. The top 10 transit systems carry 12.6 million people each workday. Now, that sounds great, but I thought about that for a second. I was like, how much does Tokyo transport? And I looked it up. Tokyo rail system alone moves 40 million people a day. So that just shows us how much room we have for growth when our top 10 systems are doing 12 million a day.
I remember being in Shinjuku train station, and I felt as if all 40 million were trying to get through there the same time as I was.
I used to live like 300 yards from the West Shinjuku entrance. And I would just videotape that and send it back to friends just to see the masses of people moving through that station. It's pretty amazing when you see it, but it works.
It does. And all the studies tell us that what people like being with other people in cities, the worst thing you can hear is being on your own and hearing kind of, you know, footsteps. But if you're in a crowd, we like social spaces. So I think high density living is coming back into the United States. I live in a neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and it's young folks walking around all the kind of time. The metro, they would use the metro, but the metro doesn't work often enough, so you'll see people using Uber or Lyft a lot. But if we had, you know, better and more mass transit along the signs of kind of Japan. They give a certain liveliness to cities and an incredible safety as people are wandering around in public spaces.
I think you've tapped into something with the generational shift, not only in terms of overall attitudes towards public policy, but their embracing of individual technology. We sometimes think of phone overusage as only a negative, but when it comes to crafting good public policy and trying to create these larger mass transit systems that are going to be quite costly, you need a generational shift. And polling shows that younger people would much prefer having a phone than a car. They're not looking forward to getting a driver's license like they did in my generation. They'd much prefer to be on a bus texting their friends on their phone or playing a game or whatever. And it's kind of changed the dynamic of what it means to get around.
It actually has, I think, that, and these generational shifts are really quite dramatic. I remember when I first came to America in 1990, the notion of gay rights was seen as some subversive, pie-in-the-sky notion that would never occur. And, you know, through time, it's been kind of taken for granted assumption now. And I think it's the same with things like mass transit, walkability, biking, public transportation. The notion of living in the suburbs and driving a big car has kind of lost its appeal. It was a time of the 40s and 50s and 60s and people who grew up with that. I think the problem is that we get these generational shifts. And the political rhetoric is always two generations behind. And we still seem to be having debates about taxation and things from the 1980s, it seems. We need more young people to vote, get involved in the political process, so that our political debates and indeed our public policies are fashioned for the world we live in now and for the, you know, for the lives we're leading now, rather than some cozy notion of the suburbs of the 1950s or the 1970s.
So, John, we've been talking about these bigger notions of investing at a greater rate into our mass transit systems, but let's talk on a more granular level. You live in the DC metro area,
mm-hmm.
and the metro was one of the shining examples of a subway system 30, 40 years ago. That's no longer the case. It still doesn't connect to Dulles Airport. If you were the governor of Maryland, or if you were in charge of the metro system, where do you start investing to try to upgrade such a massive system?
The DC one is almost in a sort of case study of what not to do. There was no guaranteed revenue stream, and it was administrative responsibility was divided between the states of Maryland, Virginia, DC, plus the federal government was involved. So there was enough cooks to spoil the broth there and not devote enough kind of resources. One of the things that they've changed, they've got a new general manager who's closed it for 24 hours, going to close large sections of it. I actually think that's the way to go, to just clear this backlog. Otherwise, it's death by a thousand cuts. One of the things that's happened in DC is that if the services go down or deteriorate, people vote with their feet, especially in a time of relatively cheap gas. So ridership peaked for a while and then has kind of tailed the waves. People can't rely on it. If I was the, I could wave a magic wand, you just want to increase the reliability of the existing service. You need that above all else, even at the cost of a slightly increased fare. But if people can't rely on public transport, they quickly move to something else. So increase the reliability of your service. That's rule number one.
It's a fascinating topic, and I've enjoyed the conversation. Professor John Rennie Short, thanks so much for joining me on Sea Change Radio.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimmy McGriff, James Taylor, and JJ Kale. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.